Hey, before your Q3 call, I've got the campaign brief ready, built from last quarter's data and the competitive landscape.
Great. Did you include the differentiation angle the CMO asked for?
Already in there. Three angles no competitor's using right now. Just need your approval.
Approved. Thanks. Oh, agents, where would we be without you?
Somewhere with a lot more tabs open.
Create your first Monday agent in minutes at monday.com.
He started here. He is here. No one knows New York better. Geraldo. 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
One hand in the air for the big city. Street lights, big dreams, all look pretty. No place in the world we can compare. Put your hand in the air, everybody say yeah.
Alicia Keys, she always makes me so proud of my town, my hometown, the town I was born in, New York City. Good morning, New York. I'm Geraldo. It is almost 8 minutes after 10 o'clock on this Thursday, the 7th day of May. I'm here along with Mr. Noam Layden. Mr. Layden, how are you?
I'm doing just great, thanks.
So have you read about Mayor de Blasio thinking that New Yorkers don't truly appreciate his greatness?
I saw this. You know, this reminds me of, you know, he says he gets much more warm, more welcome when he leaves New York City, that people understand where he's coming from. This reminds me of like a second term president who leaves to go to like the Philippines to get a wild parade because nobody back home likes him anymore.
Well, listen, the mayor has done, he's done some good things and some not so good things. The sad thing, the melancholy thing from his point of view, and this may be what Mayor de Blasio is responding to in a very, self-pitying profile of the mayor in Rolling Stone magazine when he's complaining that his predecessors, like Rudy Giuliani, their greatest achievement, well, Rudy specifically, his greatest achievement was figuring out a way to get more credit than he deserves. And he labels Michael Bloomberg, who did such a good job in terms of the administration, the fiscal administration and the social administration of the city, in my opinion. He says that Bloomberg has been too beholden to his Wall Street pals. But I want to say what I like about the mayor, and I think we should have a little debate about this. I've got so much to talk to you about today, and I'll start listing it all. But I just want to start and kind of dismiss this issue with the mayor. I think that he deserves credit for pre-K. I think universal pre-K is a great idea. I think universal pre-K for public school students is a great idea. I also believe that, crime, generally speaking, is declining, even though I think you have here and there, you have outbreaks of violence that are distressing. You have to keep an eye on. The city seems more or less orderly, which I appreciate. But there are many, many areas where the mayor has really not yet lived up to his potential, if that's the way you view him in that positive light. But let me just read from Josh Greenman in today's Daily News. I'll just read you a little bit. New York City mayors have never had small egos. You can't be shy to run this town. But Ed Koch had the wisdom and humility to ask, how am I doing? De Blasio's version of the question is, what's the matter with you for not worshiping me? The big man, 6'5" tall, tallest mayor we've ever had. One of the least punctual mayors we've ever had. And now it turns out he's got his underwear in a bundle over not being appreciated by New Yorkers. His popularity now dipping below 50% is his disapproval, passing his approval for the first time ever. Bernard McGurk, bejesus, joins us here, Bernard.
The hell are you doing, Geraldo?
So, it, uh, What is it about this this mayor, and does he have a point here?
Well, first of all, Geraldo, let me get this microphone up to my my hole here.
Okay.
Pardon my language, my mouth. Listen, the timing couldn't be worse for this article to come out. We have a cop who was executed on the street, possibly because of his policies, because of de Blasio's policies. He's lying in a casket. They're going to hold awake tonight. I understand you're going to be there. And this guy's whining that he's misunderstood, that he expanded pre-K and nobody appreciates him, because that's about his sole accomplishment in this Rolling Stone, which, by the way, the Rolling Stone is a disgraceful publication itself.
They certainly have had a rough time lately.
Yes, the Sarnaev, glamorizing Sarnaev, the killer, the Boston bomber, and the rape hoax that they got busted on. But not only that, this de Blasio still hasn't apologized for his role in the events leading up to the execution of the two cops back in
Lou and Ramos
in December. And he played a role in the events.
Exacerbating the tensions in town.
That's exactly right. He minimized before that the two cops who were assaulted on the Brooklyn Bridge. This colors everything. This is what when you think of de Blasio, you think of the cops, you think of the dead cops. And you think of the injustices that he has perpetrated, the anti-police rhetoric that he spewed, that colors everything. And safety is the number one concern in this city. In the article, he also disparages Bloomberg and Rudy Giuliani, who handed him over a safe city. And he says that they really didn't make this city safe. He says the narrative has been misunderstood about Giuliani saving the city, though he disagrees with the city council wanting to do away with the broken windows policy. He essentially in this article says that he agrees with the city council, Melissa Viverito lady.
All right, so that's Bernard McGurk, a very acutely negative take on Mayor de Blasio. Earl Lewis, the ace from New York One, may have a different opinion. Earl also joins us. He was generally very positive and supportive of the mayor when he came into office. So, Earl, why don't you respond to Bernard, our pal, first, before I ask you some specific questions.
Think probably one place where we probably agree is that the mayor has national ambitions that I think a lot of local New Yorkers find jarring, that he is sort of patting himself on the back at times in ways that people say, well, it's a little early for that. You know, you've only got 14 months under your belt. But I can tell you, I just did a sit-down interview with him a little over a week ago, and he believes it in the marrow of his bones that no mayor of New York can accomplish but so much without help from the federal government.
Well, let me ask you this, Earl. Do you believe that Mayor Bill de Blasio has helped or exacerbated the racial divide in New York City?
Oh, I mean, look, he didn't invent it, right?
He certainly didn't invent it. I didn't ask you if he invented it. I asked, did he make it better or worse?
I think you can't do – you know what? I'd say better. In part, just anecdotally today, I'm riding the A-train, and I see for the first time in, you know, a generation, posters saying, look, if you've experienced housing discrimination, here's a number to call at the city of New York. We'll do something about it. These laws have been on the books since 1968, and nobody's touched them in 20 years. You know, so I mean,
yeah. And yet you walk around, you talk to cops, and they're all muttering under their breaths, "How dare this man? And how? Why make us the enemy? Why?
Well,
undo the engine of the great progress we've done."
You tell me a year in this town when cops weren't muttering under their breaths, complaining about something. You know, and I say that as the son of a cop, the brother of a cop. They complain. It's what they do, you know? I mean,
Thanksgiving must be fun at your house.
Yeah, nobody ever quite gets it right. They don't like politicians. I get that, you know? But the reality is crime is not out of control. People have been saying, you know, since the mayor got elected, people have been saying since September, the city's going to go to hell in a handbasket, it's going to all fall apart, and none of that has happened. And those people don't change the rhetoric at all. They still say the city's falling apart, even though every number shows that it's not falling apart.
But Noam Layden, what the problem is here is a self-satisfied, smug man who won't even go so far as to endorse the obvious candidate for his party, the Democratic Party, a woman he worked for back in the year 2000. He's even grander than Hillary Clinton.
You know, you've left out conveniently half of this survey that you talked about in the Wall Street Journal, where African Americans and Latinos love the job that Mayor de Blasio is doing. The numbers in this poll even say so. Some 58-60% say he's doing the right thing. Some 58-60% say they'd reelect him. So,
and white people?
And white people know. White people dislike him in huge numbers.
So what is the answer to my question? Has he exacerbated or helped heal the racial divide?
Well, you know, when he strode into office, he seemed to stride into office as the mayor who would represent the people who hadn't been represented in the past. That's the way he sold himself. And so in that case, those populations who came out on Election Day, on that Election Day when nobody showed up, was mostly minorities.
All right, it's 866-HERALDO. Where do you fall on this? I'm going to do one more segment on this. We've got a lot of important business, but as long as we have two aces, well, I'm not discounting Noam Layden, but Earl Lewis and Bernard McGurk, we'll take your calls at 16 after 10 o'clock. We'll be right back.
The headlines, the city's most pressing issues, Geraldo, today and every day, 77 WABC.
New York voters think the city is headed in the wrong direction. 45% say it is not. Getting that out of the New York Post, the Daily News, the editorial board says that de Blasio's insulting arrogance will be remembered as a milestone of Mayor Mee's mayoralty. What do you think? I'm here with Bernard McGurk and Earl Lewis on the line, along with the Noam Layden, your turn, 866 Geraldo. We'll go to John first in Rockland. What's up, John? What do you think of the mayor?
Oh, my gosh. Geraldo, thanks for taking my call. This guy set the tone early on from the Eric Garner case when all that rioting was going on and when they attacked the police on the bridge. And now we have five cops shot, three dead. That would have never happened under Giuliani or the Bloomberg. Say what you want about Giuliani, but he... Here you are with us, the police. I'm retired. I was there in the 80s when things were really bad. And he took the cuffs off us. We were able to go in there and do our job. And that residual carried on with the Bloomberg administration. Now you got this guy, really, who's a socialist communist running the city. And now he's anti-cop. Come on.
That's right. And he makes Bernie Sanders sound like Barry Goldwater, for God's sake.
Wasn't that a great joke that Obama told at the White House Correspondents' Dinner about Bernie Sanders running for president, the pot-smoking socialist? There will be a third Obama term after all.
That's right. He was good.
I loved it. Earl Lewis has gone. He's got a class. But our buddy in Rikers, Ray's on the line. What's up, Ray?
Hey, buddy. How are you? Listen, I caught the tail end of someone that said that the city... It's not going to pot. Listen, homicides are up 6.7% since January. We have three cops dead. Listen, objectively speaking, you as a journalist, Mr. Rivera, let's do this. The new program that Branton and de Blasio have set up, it's like a radar. You follow shots where they're fired.
Right.
Let's take the data on that since the day was implemented, and let's add that up at the end of August through the summer. And let's see how shootings are over. You tell me that this city is not going to pot because the...
Oh, I hope you're wrong, man. I absolutely hope you're wrong. All right, Jerry in Glendale. What's up, Jerry?
You know, de Blasio acts as if he's got a mandate because they say 73% of the people voted for him. But what they don't realize is that only about 17% of the residents voted. So he doesn't have a mandate. And now he's at 49% of the people think he stinks.
49% of the voters think he stinks.
Can I ask Earl a question?
Earl's teaching a class. It's just Bernard McGurk, but he probably agrees with it.
I want to know when they're bringing back Curtis on New York One. The show stinks without him.
Nice guy. So Curtis, I can't believe he sleeps here now. He's a guy's really beleaguered, isn't he?
Well, he's got a very complicated life, does Curtis Lee. Well, he's doing a million things. He's still active in the Guardian Angels, you know. He's still out there fighting crime. And
I appreciate that. I've known him longer than anyone. I think we may have done the first national takeout on Curtis, but... I kind of lament the melancholy reality of him showering here in the radio studio high above Madison Square Garden.
He's got about four ex-wives. They're all looking for money, and then he ends up getting suspended from New York One.
And de Blasio thinks that he has troubles.
Yeah, really.
That he's underappreciated. Frankie in Brooklyn, what are you thinking about, Frankie?
I'll tell you the truth, Geraldo, and thank you for taking my call. It's kind of like, who really is the mayor? And what's influencing what's going on there? The polls. Polls, I think they could be adjusted in some ways, maybe to tame society at a certain time by saying there's less of this and there's less of that. I don't see it happen. But what really gets me upset, Geraldo, is where's the outrage in the white community?
I mean, it's there. I think that there's more of a muttering in the white community. I mean, I live in the Upper East Side. You can't get, I mean, if it's not white, it's definitely upper middle class in the sense that anybody, regardless of race, color, creed, or religion, lives there. But generally speaking, are people of some means, and they are muttering about taxes more than anything. I tell you, I don't get. And I don't know how you feel about this. I insist that the minimum wage has to be increased across the board in this country. And I think that Republicans who complain about point to the Obama administration and say it's responsible for income inequality, that's gross, this hypocrisy, unless they are also in favor of a minimum wage increase. Don't you think that in that sense, Bernard McGuirk, the progressives represented by de Blasio and to a less extreme extent Hillary Clinton are on the right track in that regard?
Possibly, but of course, when I graduated from the Wharton School of Economics, I was taught that if you force a minimum wage hike, you cost people jobs. Some people will benefit, but others, there will be less jobs.
Did you really graduate from the Wharton School of Economics?
No, I did not.
Oh, you mean the one in Rockaway?
The one in my mind, yeah.
The one in Long Beach.
Right, that one, yeah. Yeah. Bob Wharton taught it.
But it's Bobby Wharton.
On the boardwalk, yeah.
77.
Bernard, thanks.
ABC. Live, local, on it. 866 Geraldo, where New York comes to talk. 77 WABC.
The conclusion reached, and I really didn't get to it, very distressing, that racism is alive and well in Baltimore. Noam said in the commercial break he can't imagine it's much different in other places, but then we started talking about it, and Baltimore is a southern town still, and it's stuck. It seems stuck to me in the 60s.
Well, you know, you made that observation. You might not remember this, but last week during your radio program down there, you said it felt like they were 20 years behind New York, at least in the African-American community in West Baltimore.
And they seem to have that that whole defeated attitude that black people in New York don't have, generally speaking, to me. I mean, a kind of a deflated feeling, apathy. That's the word that you don't have much in New York. You don't. New Yorkers are not apathetic. What I found in Baltimore was apathy was the generalized sentiment. This apathy 98% of the time, and then 2% of the time it's rage. And the apathy just is not serving.
Like they've given up? That kind
of apathy? It seems like that almost, that this is my lot in life, and this is going to be my lot in life. It was my father's lot in life. It'll be my son's lot in life.
But how many abandoned buildings? That tells you something,
35,000,
right?
Yes, in a city of 600,000.
One city. That's
a city that's not even the size of, half of Brooklyn.
That's apathy right there.
We'll be back to your calls, 866-Geraldo, after the news break.
He started here. He is here. No one knows New York better. Geraldo, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance.
Eva Perón would have been 96 years old today. When I came to New York, when I fell in love with Edie Vonnegut, this is going way, way back, 1971, 1972, the daughter of the great author Kurt Vonnegut ultimately became my second wife. We hung out at one of our best friends was Giorgio Sanangelo, a fabulous director. He invented the Indian look. Remember the American Indian look?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously, weren't even born, but the fashion statement, just look it up, for a time, for 10 minutes, everyone was dressing as an Indian in that era. And Giorgio was Argentine-born, Giorgio Sanangelo. He was of Italian descent, but born in Argentina. And he used to talk about Eva Perón, how he used to go outside the Casa Rosada, the White House there, just to catch a glimpse of Eva when Eva Perón, when she was First Lady of Argentina. And the boyishness of his adoration, how he cherished her.
Right.
That was real. It was an adoring love. It set the stage for me then to fall so heavily for Evita when the play came out and et cetera. And you know, don't go into
anything. No, I'm curious. I wasn't going to go there, I promise.
Okay.
But, you know, when you were married to her, I imagine, you know, having Kurt Vonnegut as your father-in-law, you must have met, like, so many fascinating people.
Everybody. I mean, and Norman Mail, all the great writers of the time all hung out together. And it was such a, I mean, the literary scene in New York in those days was fantastic. And for a young blue-collar, you know, striver like me to be thrust into the middle of that heady intellectual, these were the greats. They were, you know, it was just an amazing time. Something I never really wrote about that to the extent that I should have.
What was, if you don't mind me asking, because I'm curious about this, I love Kurt Vonnegut. What was he like?
He was kind of a gangly guy, maybe, I don't know, 6'1" or 2", kind of always disheveled, always had a distracted air, kind of sandy hair, all curly and unkempt. You know, he wore suits the way academics,
all wrinkly.
Kind of all wrinkly and everything. And he had the most amazing sense of humor. And, you know, he'd say something and you'd realize how funny it was after a time and explosively laugh. And Susan Sarandon was here recently. She had visited with Edie in the same house where we married in Barnstable in Cape Cod. Actually, Marty Berman, he kind of produced the whole wedding.
Oh, he did. I could see him doing that.
But I told her, you know, I remember that house so fondly, and how Kurt had something called the Marsh Tromp, where you go to the marshes there, the salt marshes in Barnstable and Cape Cod, and the idea was you pick a point on the horizon and you walk to it directly, regardless of obstacles. So you'd be into the muck and the salt marsh, and you'd go underwater, and you come up, and you just keep walking. And Susan Sarandon, who was here doing a show, she said, I just came back and we did a Marsh Tromp, and she showed me her arms were all mosquito bitten from that. So they continued the tradition. But he was just the most amazing, amazing man. I don't want to start naming all of the great authors who hung around. I'll leave some out, but just the...
But Norman Mailer, that's much bigger than that.
But it was just an amazing, amazing scene. And there I went and talked for 5 minutes about the good old days. And I want to get back to you, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get back to our focus. And then another lady called during the break and said that I sounded very depressed today. That professor kind of bummed me out. But, and you know, these are, let's face it, despite the spring fabulousness of this rebirth that's going on all around us and the blooming and the leaves and everything else, there is a loss in our family, isn't there? I mean, that's what the Moore family is, all of us. And Brian Moore, that officer shot in the face who died and whose wake will be held today in Bethpage and whose funeral will be tomorrow, was one of us. He's our son, isn't he? You know, and as much as we want to heal everything, and spring is a time of healing, we cannot be unrealistic about the violence that took this man's life. And the separation between how we are grieving these various events and my feeling that, you know, race relations are going back to the bad old days. You know what it reminds me a lot of? And I'm going to get to you calls 866-HERALDO momentarily. You know, I came up, obviously, co-chairman of the Black and Brown Lawyers Caucus and representing, aside from the Young Lords, all the other activist groups, Black, Brown, and all the rest, and coming, so much of my practice and my background coming from the streets, and my daytime show particularly was supported for many years, primarily by a minority audience, a largely Black audience, watching daytime program who's home. I mean, it's a factor of demographics, and that's always been the context in which I operated and my fallback and my friends in the community. And then the O.J. Simpson murders happened. And in the O.J. Simpson murders, there became a race loyalty issue with O.J. Simpson. To me, it was clear, unequivocal, that this man, the juice, this football great,
you know, running for 2,000 yards in the snow in Buffalo. I mean, this guy was magnificent. The Hertz commercials, you know, leaping through the airport, running to catch his plane. O.J. Simpson was an icon, a fabulous icon, but O.J. Simpson was a low-down and dirty murderer. And I busted his chops on it and pursued him through the whole time and lamented grievously when the jury acquitted him at the state level. And if you saw the cameras, the live shot cameras on the audiences, the various audiences reacting as in real time, the foreman of the jury read the verdict. White people were despondent and visibly disappointed by the acquittal. And black people, at least those who were pictured by the live cameras at universities with, you know, generally speaking, they tended to go to universities, so it's mostly black student groups, were elated when O.J. Simpson was acquitted. But the reason I bring it up is the tension I had then with Malik Shabazz, who was the head of the new Black Panther Party at that time, and others in the black community, reminded me very much of this negative feedback that I'm getting from the black community regarding the Baltimore riots and personal responsibility and my feeling of how hip-hop has been so destructive of the black family life and has distorted, I think, values and aspirations in many ways. And I lament that it's come to this again, that I'm in this place again. I want to work through this, of course, with reason and conversation, and people know me. As you know, I went during the height of the O.J. Simpson discord, I went to a black church in Washington and did my talk show at the black church in Washington, D.C., where people say, you know, you, Geraldo Rivera, you betrayed us. You're a race traitor. You know, you, how could you, you know, forget where you came from? It's where, you know, it's one thing when a white person does it. It's another thing when you do it. How could you? How dare you? And no, don't come home to us now. You know, so it was very sad, and I feel some of that vibe now.
You know, what's interesting, though, is when you pick O.J., I mean, O.J., for a lot of those African-Americans who were, you know, high-fiving each other, he was a symbol, right? I mean,
right.
Maybe they believed he was innocent, but maybe some of them felt he was guilty. But they said, here's somebody who walked into the courts, and maybe they felt like he was treated like a white person might be treated if they had entered the courts, and that their experiences walking into a court as an African-American, they feel it's different than it is as walking into a court as a white person. Same when they're stopped by police. They're handled differently when police officers stop them as an African-American, as a white person. Here we are, 2015. How many years later?
When it was 1994, so it's 20
years later. And the argument is exactly the same.
The argument is, and it's so... it's so sad. And there were people at the time who said, yeah, well, maybe he got over. How many black men have been taken down unjustly? So maybe he is one that, you know, he defied the odds and he went the other direction. And maybe he got a fortuitous conclusion to his personal situation. But how many went the other direction? Yeah, I guess that's I can see that in some cosmic term. But I call it the way I see it, man. I call it the way I see it. The race card falls where it may. If Geraldo Rivera can't be frank about it, then who can? You know, because I have this sort of, you know, what am I? I'm kind of like, what is being Jewish and Puerto Rican? You know, how many?
It's confusing. Is what it is.
And it's kind of like, what is the racial line? I'm almost like post-racial in a
right.
way. I feel myself that way. I'm like a post-racial person. I mean, I don't go around use the N-word. I'm not like that kind of in crowd. I understand the boundaries, but I am someone who can almost go both ways in that sense. But I'm very disappointed. If I feel deflated today, it's because of the context and the wake and all that's going on. So I don't, I've over-talked and now I have to take a quick commercial, but when I come back, I promise you, it's all about you at 866 Geraldo. I appreciate those calls, Ralph, Joan, Freddie, Mello, Jim, Mario, etc. Stay on the line. We're going to give that Genucel gift pack to the best female caller of the day, and we haven't gotten there yet, so we shall address that and give away the free hundreds of dollars worth of value to the best female caller. And all of you guys, don't think I'm giving you a short trip either. We'll be back 18 after 11 o'clock.
Live and local, the Tri-State's most important issues with Geraldo, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
Welcome back, 24 minutes after 11 o'clock on this Thursday, the 7th day of May. 2015, oh, how the century flies. Joan is on the line from Queens. Hi, Joan. Thank you very much for calling us. How are you today?
Hi, Geraldo. With regard to the black problem, that woman that was slapping her son around was made a heroine. And yet she had six kids.
Chavo Graham, yeah.
Six children with six different men. Now, you're going to tell me that she helps them with homework and such? This is why the blacks don't get ahead. They have teenagers are having sex. You think that they want to stay home and raise a kid, really, once they have a kid? They're not going to stay home and help them with homework. And that's the problem. And if I may make a second point, you suggested that we pay the fathers to come into the home?
Yes.
Well, how would you decide? Who's going to decide what to pay them? And how about this woman with six different fathers? We're supposed to pay each father for staying in the home?
I think that you have to. I don't know how to design the program, but I appreciate your call. Excellent call, by the way. I don't know how you design the program. I just know that there are ways that you'll know. Herman Badillo is going to be honored at City College. Herman Badillo used to complain about aid to dependent children, that it was structured to accelerate the destruction of the family. Why? Because to have aid to dependent children, you need a dependent child. How do you have a dependent child unless there's not a dad there? It's only a single mom. Now you have a dependent child. Now the state comes in. The state becomes the father. That was the program. The program was aid to dependent children. So Badillo astutely pointed out, he had a track much like mine, his widow Gail reminds me, when he was a young liberal Democrat, the borough president of the Bronx, congressman, first Puerto Rican congressman representing the Bronx, everybody loved him. When he became a Republican and started saying, what about personal responsibility? People started calling him a racist. And Badillo, pointing out the flaws in aid to dependent children, said, how can this program be working? These women must have men around. Why? Because they keep having children. So there has to be a man around. And he pointed that out, and he got a lot of gas from it. All I'm saying is that aid to dependent children, which no longer exists, they have a different approach now, and they have a kind of a credit card that's like a cash card. It's a different setup. But I really believe that there are ways to, you can note what is the positive, socially progressive, positive activity that helped your family. You can figure it out, and I think you have to reward good conduct. We have to break now this malaise I talked about, this apathy that I talked about. We've got to break through that. We have to change. I have people talking about reparations for slavery and nonsense like that. Instead of that, let's reward good conduct, regardless of the race. I mean, if you have anyone who falls in the, that's the other untold story, how many poor whites are using these programs, and who makes up the ranks of the people with disabilities of this sort or that sort. You know, white people use and access these programs just, and I don't have the statistics in front of me, but the stereotype that you conjure in your mind, you think of a welfare queen. I just said the word welfare queen. I bet you have an image in your mind, and I bet it's not of some white lady in Indiana. But I just think that you can be proactive now in helping change attitudes, snap people out of the apathy, and go forward in a way that's positive, that's progressive. I think raising minimum wage is one clear example of that. That's an easy one that everyone can understand. You can't pay people $7. Imagine that. I'm even saying the word. Every day at breakfast, $7.25 an hour. I mean, that's not a wage. That's not a wage. That's like a tip. Okay, let me go to Freddie in New Milford. Go ahead, Freddie. What's up?
Hey, good morning, Geraldo. Just to go on exactly what you're saying, I think it is the break up the family that makes the unemployment. Because I work with both income, the low income of black and whites. And the poor white people, they'll work their head off just hoping they get a family. Black guy, he just pretty much works for himself. And unless you give an employer a reason to, like, think that you need him, they ain't going to hire you. And I say that.
Now, are you careful, Freddie, that you're not just stereotyping? Are you giving us your real personal experience?
Well, yeah, because all the successful black people that I've been around have been family guys.
Well, I'd love to hear from a black man calling to respond to your call. 866-ARALDO is the number. We can talk more about this. The lines will be open the rest of the show. Right now, though, we've got to catch up on lots of different headlines. And who better than Noam Layden with the news?
The sound of the city, Geraldo, where New York comes to talk. 77 WABC.
Just, I don't want to name drop. I mentioned that through Kurt Vonnegut, my late former father-in-law, I met all the glitterati, the literary sect, and writers seem to be more socially prominent in those. Listen, I just made some notes just in that commercial break. I was just thinking. So Pete Hamill, Jimmy Breslin, they were more of
Jimmy Breslin, that's pretty cool.
Norman Mailer, Philip Roth.
Wow.
Philip Roth.
What's Philip Roth like? I love Philip Roth.
He's got his own goofiness. No, he's
still
famous
around.
Newark, right? He's still around. Gore Vidal, Gay Talese, Arthur Miller, Truman Capote.
Come on.
Joseph Heller, Allen Ginsberg, Joyce Carol Oates, Maya Angelou. I mean, just...
Wow.
I mean, imagine that for a pitcher from West Babylon.
Right. That's pretty cool.
Living on Avenue C, and there's the people that you're hanging with are the people that are in many ways defined the second half of the 20th century in literary. And you remember Mailer actually ran for mayor at one point.
Oh, did he?
And Mailer and Jimmy Breslin, they ran on the same ticket. And William Buckley was the senator.
Breslin.
No, I got it backwards. No. James, what was the senator's name? Shoot. Now, which Buckley was the...
I can't help you with this, and I don't know who you're talking about.
Well, you know, William Buckley, the famous conservative writer, and his brother, what was his brother, the senator's name?
Joe.
That
Peter.
Wasn't Joe. Wasn't
What was Breslin like? Because he was such a
Breslin
character.
Breslin's still around. His children is Christopher, let me see, what's his brother's name, brother? So William Buckley, what's his father? Someone help me. What's the Buckley who was the senator? Senator Buckley. Can we just Google it? Senator Buckley. So embarrassing. Huh? It's no help at all. Senator Buckley. James Buckley. James Buckley. He was.
Sure, there you go.
Yeah. There you go. No, it wasn't James Buckley. No, that was the judge.
This might have to wait till tomorrow.
Oh, man. I will never do that again. James Buckley? No.
There's a James Buckley who was a senator.
There was?
Yeah.
From New York?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's him. That was William Buckley's brother.
His wife's name was Ann, by the way. Just in case you're curious.
Oh, man. All right, I'll see you tomorrow.